The Guardian.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Last time we brought you news of a deal done in Brussels to save the European economy. This week, the champagne's back on ice. The Greek Prime Minister has insisted it's time to put the bailout deal to his very angry people. Now, as the G20 assembles in Cannes, the EU have told him you'll get no more money till Greece agrees to the conditions attached. But as we record, it's entirely unclear whether the Papandreou government can even survive. Also this week, the unhappy campers of the Occupy London campaign at St Paul's Cathedral have claimed their first resignations. But is their cause really helped by creating headaches for bishops rather than bankers? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian columnist Madeleine Bunting, our financial guru Nils Prattley, and down the line, the political commentator and sage Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. The ancient Greek philosopher Plato didn't like democracy very much. He thought that ordinary people were too ignorant to know what was good for them. And indeed, if Plato was plying his trade in today's Athens, he'd probably be on the side of the EU. Its officials are said to be tearing out their collective hair at Papandreou's plan to put last week's bailout deal to a referendum. Having given up on the unruly Greek government, it is now seeking to dictate terms directly to the Greek people. The message: vote yes or else you're on your own. Nils Prattley, let's just take a step back. You followed this thing from blow by blow, the beginning. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How did Greece get to this position, first of all?
It borrowed too much money and was allowed to borrow too much money. All the while, its economy became less and less competitive vis-a-vis particularly Germany, but other big European countries. The Greek government of the time, either willfully or blindly, was not transparent about how much debt was being run up. And sooner or later, the balloon was bound to go up.
Right. And so it has. It's often said in financial reporting the markets don't like uncertainty. Well, they've got a big dose of that just now, haven't they?
They have got an enormous amount of uncertainty. First of all, I mean, we're talking mid-morning Thursday, where the big news is that the Greek finance minister, Angelos Venizelos, who's continued his busy week. He's been to hospital, he's been to Cannes, and now he's back in Athens, and he said he no longer supports the referendum. So we don't know whether the referendum will proceed. We don't know whether there'll be a Greek government in place this time tomorrow. So there is uncertainty upon uncertainty. For the EU leaders, clearly they hate the idea of a referendum, but they may also hate the idea of not knowing what sort of Greek government will follow. I mean, it may be there's a faction within that government that thinks it can renegotiate terms with the EU and get a better deal for Greece, despite the ultimatum that has apparently issued yesterday. So it is uncertainty upon uncertainty. And all the while, you know, the clock ticks because Greece has to make payments on its bonds, on its short-term debt. And, you know, what one day, unless the money comes from the EU, it will run out of money.
I mean, one of the interesting things is we talk about the markets, but Greece is kind of beyond the markets now, isn't it? It's dependent on these bailouts. But, of course, the thing that's really spooky in the EU is what it means for other countries like Italy that still are in the markets.
Yeah, clearly, if Greece were to come out of the euro and were to default, then all the other parts, or the two other parts of the rescue package that was agreed last week, really start to unravel as well, because, you know, the hole in the European banking system becomes even bigger because a lot of those banks hold Greek debt. So 106 billion, which was last week's figure, you know, it's going to, you know, double it at least. And the chances of getting the rescue fund, the European Financial Stability Facility, up and running really becomes, you know, pretty poor prospects there, because, you know, if you are the Chinese, who are the great hope, who might come along and pour a few billions into it, from the point of view of Beijing, if you're looking at this, you just don't know what you're investing in. There could be referendums left, right and centre. You really don't know what's a reasonable price to demand to support the EFSF.
And, gosh, Mike, I mean, what's your overall sense that politics is catching back up with economics?
No, politics is racing behind the economics, but it always has done. Although, paradoxically, the euro was a political project I remember when it was a hot issue in Britain about 10 years ago, saying, this won't work. You can't have a currency without a polity. I thought it sounded smart, but it was actually pompous. What I meant was, you can't have a currency without a state. And that's what we've got here. We've got a clash between the economic imperatives of the single currency in the markets and the fact that the Greeks, and indeed many people in this country and most other countries, say, hang on, we didn't vote for this. And they didn't, though they signed on, and for 10 years they got the benefits of it. Certainly the Greeks did. The more you hear about the way public affairs have been conducted in Greece in terms of salaries, jobs, work rates, pensions, retirement age and everything else, they had a pretty good time. So it's not just about the Greek political and economic elites misleading their people. That's what people say in all countries. But, you know, we all enjoyed the party, and the party's got to stop. One last thing. Every time you hear a British government minister say, we've got to do what we've got to do or we'll be like the Greeks, it was a dishonest formulation when David Cameron first used it, and it still is. We do have a problem, a real problem, with our debt and our deficit, but the more we know about Greece, and they knew quite a lot about Greece at the time, it's a silly and misleading comparison. We can do better than that.
So Britain's very different from Greece, but Greece is where it is today. Whether, Mike, this thing is settled through an early general election, and who knows how that will go, or through a referendum, if you think of the ordinary Greek voter who's maybe not steeped in economic theory and whether, you know, optimal currency area and all that kind of malarkey.
He's steeped in a credit card standard of living at the moment, as are we all, but the Greeks are rather more so, and they've got better weather, Tom.
I think if there are Greeks listening, which I rather doubt there'll be many of them, they might take exception to that. They're already suffering a lot of austerity, aren't they, Nils?
Yeah, they're suffering an enormous amount of austerity. The GDP's fallen, 15% or something. I mean, the talk is, you know, the threat, at least from the EU, is that, you know, you'll be going back to the 1960s if you come out of the euro in default. You know, quite possible. I mean, when Mike talks about, you know, the difference between the Greek position and the British position, absolutely right. I mean, you can always also make distinction between the Greek position and the Irish position. I mean, the Irish, their GDP per capita was a lot higher than Greece. It obviously was quite high within the eurozone at the moment of crisis. It is relatively easy for them to suffer a sort of 20-25% drop in living standards because they're turning the clock back to, say, you know, 2005-2004. It's rather harder for Greece starting from further back. You know, the hit is greater.
And the Irish are doing unexpectedly well, aren't they, Neil?
Very well. They're doing very well. I mean, you know, there's still a question. I mean, if Greece were to go and the euro crisis were to explode again, you know, that may well create knock-on problems for Ireland, probably would. But, you know, Ireland has a path through.
And let's hear it for the Germans at this point. I mean, they all think we should behave like Germans and export more and consume less and all the rest of it. But they've been through a Greek crisis. People forget this. They've been funding the East Germans, their local Greeks, for the last 20 years. It's cost West German taxpayers billions, far, far more than Helmut Kohl, the man behind the euro, said at the time. And, you know, they're already pretty hacked off, but they are at least fellow Germans. And although they look down on the Aussies, as I think they call them, you know, they're fellow Germans, and the historic mission of Germany is to be reunited, blah, blah, blah. They certainly don't feel that way about the Greeks. And, of course, the Greeks don't feel that way about the Germans, who invaded their country well within living memory and have produced some thoroughly unpleasant cartoons of Mrs. Merkel in a SS uniform, not kind to your loan shark.
Madeline, do you worry at all, putting the economics aside, about like what this might mean for the way different peoples in Europe regard each other? You know, the Germans seem to be having a very strong view, as Mike's saying, that other people should be more like them, and the resentment in Greece is, we read, stepping up. I mean, do you see Europe becoming much more fractious?
Yes, I think an economic crisis of this magnitude always strains every kind of political arrangement. It also puts sort of intolerable pressures on all kinds of institutions, all kinds of political dispensations, but the fallout can land in very unexpected places. I was very struck, for example, a very tiny anecdote, but my son's German exchange student, 14-year-old, turns up, can barely string a sentence together in English or like any 14-year-old can't really string money sentences together anyway. But he knew one thing, the Greeks need to pay their money. You know, they need to pay their way out. Why should we pay for them? And that is obviously kind of permeating the entire country to sort of get through to 14-year-old boys. So the strains which reawaken historical historical and not really that resolved resentments. I mean, you know, obviously mentioning the war is problematic for very many reasons, but it comes right back to the fore again.
Absolutely. And Mike, I mean, you know, there's been talk in the last few days about the Greek army being reshuffled, and then stories about how, oh, don't worry, we were planning on doing this anyway, but no one knows if to believe them. The problem, however outraged Merkel and co. might be with the Greeks, is they can't in the end put tanks on the street, can they? So they can't tell Greece what to do.
Well, if you read some of the Fleet Street tabloids, they can indeed do that. I think we're getting a little carried away. It's very close to the surface. I mean, we all forget there was a coup in Greece in, I think, 1967, the military coup overthrew the monarchy. Last referendum the Greeks had when they got their democracy back in 74 was to vote no to King Constantine. I still think he lives in Surrey. There, of course, was a terrible civil war at the end of the Second World War in Greece between the forces of the right and the communists, the guerrillas who had been up in the hills fighting the Germans. Stalin signed over Greece to the West on that famous piece of paper, which he ticked with a blue tick, and Winston Churchill brought home. It was Western sphere of influence. The Greek communists were betrayed. British troops were on the streets of Athens. All this is, you know, remembered by people not much older than me, and it's part of the national folk memory. So it's pretty scary stuff. They're in the European Union, these people. This is, after all, a democratic club. But in Greece, as in one or two other countries in Eastern Europe, the strains are enormous on the politics as well as on the economics because, you know, we got the template wrong. We raced too far with economic convergence without having real economic convergence, without the economies performing more like each other. They just took the euro and had a good time with it instead of concentrating on economic reform. This sounds terribly harsh, but that's what everyone is supposed to do, and everyone was meant to benefit in a wholesome way, not in a credit splurge way.
Yeah, it's scary stuff, and there is a scary whisper doing the rounds, which it does seem to be taken quite seriously in policy circles, that it was actually the Greek military that was sort of leaning on Papandreou to make him call a referendum. I mean, it's blimey. pure speculation, but I was talking to somebody senior about that yesterday, and he was taking the idea seriously, not endorsing it, but thinking it was potentially plausible.
Blimey.
Just across the Aegean, the Turkish moderate Islamic government has just replaced most of its military leaders as well. And that's another country, an important country, far more important than Greece, which has a tense relationship between the politicians and the military.
Well, from one chaotic version of direct democracy to another, this time on the increasingly chilly streets of central London, where campaigners remain camped outside St Paul's Cathedrals, now having been there for 3 weeks. They began with an intention to occupy the London Stock Exchange, but that didn't work out. They ended up outside the famous Dome of St Paul's, and they've had really quite a big impact, although not necessarily the one they'd have expected. 3 Church of England officials have resigned over conflicting views about how to deal with their new neighbours. But as we record, once again, no bankers have resigned. The Occupy movement has been very careful not to issue any demands, but I caught up with one of its activists, Naomi Colvin, and began by asking what exactly it was that she was trying to bring attention to.
The problems we're trying to draw attention to, and I think this goes for Occupy movements all over the world, actually, is we are looking at a financial system which is out of control, and we're looking at the reasons why it's got out of control. And essentially this means that government isn't doing its job in protecting people from bankers who have got out of control, because they've been allowed to get out of control. So what we're doing has 2 strands. We yes, we want bankers to know that they should have a certain sense of social responsibility, but also we're looking at government to enforce a kind of responsibility as well.
Is it 2-3 weeks in and you've got more of the establishment talking than you can ever have expected?
I've almost lost track of what day it is, to be quite honest with you. But yeah, you're right. We started off with some stupendous media attention. And it seemed incredible from that point that we could actually become more prominent than we were. But that seems to have happened. And to sort of bring about, how can I put this? Bringing to the fore a long-standing division within one of our major national institutions and to see sort of the right side win, actually. It's incredibly satisfying. Of course it is.
You're alluding there, of course, to the developments within the Church of England. But when you started, and I imagine even now, your guns were really trained on the bankers rather than the bishops. And yet the resignations and the upheaval we've had has been within the C of E and not within, I don't know, Citibank or anything like that, has it?
Well, the upheaval within the C of E has been about whether the Church of England needs to be talking about things which are affecting ordinary people, how much the CV should be involved in, you know, a dominant strand in the national conversation. And that, in a way, speaks to us establishing what we're doing as part of the national conversation. So I don't really accept that, you know, we're on a crusade against the banks, which in itself is a bit of an oversimplification, and we've been distracted by having to deal with the cathedral. We have, what we've done is we have pinpointed and brought in a number of allies to bring that and actually sort of help them move this institution, which is very much part of the establishment, in the direction that a lot of the people who are members of it wanted to move in.
They seem slightly, to me from the outside, slightly readier to resign than the politicians that we normally talk about on this show.
Yeah, you're right, actually.
As well, as you'll be aware, along with lots of positive media coverage, you've also got lots of negative media coverage who are saying you're incoherent, you're incoherent, you're incohesive. You wouldn't know what an argument was if it hit you over the head. What would you say to those critics? Are you going to end up with a programme of like reforms to capitalism you'd like to see, and what kind of things?
Whether we emerge with a programme is up for debate. We have now started to move on now, sort of this existential crisis that we had to think about with legal issues, which took up a lot of, you know, a lot of our time, basically, as you can understand. Now that's sort of resolved to all intents and purposes, we are beginning to think more seriously about policy. Our first policy group has convened, and yeah, it's looking at the City of London, and it's now deciding how it's going to work. I think, yeah, so there will be policy statements of some sort, whatever form they take. But I think a lot of people miss what it is we're actually doing out there. I think there's a perception, possibly fostered by some elements of the media, not your good selves, that there's a lot of people just like hanging around, sitting around in tents, you know, doing whatever it is we do, doing nothing. And nothing could really be further from the truth, because I've never worked as hard as I have at Occupy. And Occupy is full of people working really, really, really hard at building up structures from nothing.
So, Madeline, you've been down to the Occupy London site. What do you make of it, and what do you make of the critique that, like Naomi said, they're working very hard, they're in creating their own community, but are they really addressing issues that go beyond their community in a coherent way?
Well, I think there's lots of aspects of the occupation that are really impressive and fantastically successful. I think what they are trying to do is clear a kind of space, and that's, you know, very astutely a physical space in an iconic part of our capital city. That is also kind of sort of symbolic for the kind of creative, imaginative space that they're trying to create in the national conversation, where they're just saying something very, very simple, which is that this is not working. This financial system is not conducive to human well-being. We've got to think again. And in a way, the simplicity of the message, I think, is one of its greatest strengths. So rather than sort of coming along with a great kind of dossier of what needs to be done and how to put it all right, they are saying, let's start the conversation. And don't just leave it to experts. Get stuck in. I think that kind of inclusivity, that kind of invitation, is part of what makes it so impressive. So if you just turn up at St. Paul's, you know, you get sort of drawn in, people start talking to you, strangers start coming up to you, what's your name, my name is, And within a very short period of time, I was, you know, cup of tea, free meal, would you like to buy, you know, look at these books, would you like to go along to the Tent City University? It's demonstrating something that needs to happen on a much wider scale in lots and lots of other places, which is a process of kind of learning and education and a sort of civic engagement. So, you know, there's all kinds of rough, raw edges to this, but I think that's actually part of its strength. You know, we've had staged, managed politics for, you know, 20-plus years, and it really has disengaged a whole bunch of people. And this is about politics in a much, much kind of rawer state.
Interesting. Mike, often in the past, these kind of rather vague, you could say, protests against capitalism, like the carnival against capitalism around about the turn of the century, you had the sense they were speaking for themselves, but this time there's been editorials and articles in surprising quarters, the Times, the Financial Times, and so on, and we've got little bits of opinion polling evidence, and it's hard to get the questions neutral, that suggests that the wider public are interested or at least instinctively sympathetic to what the protesters are trying to do, even though, as Madeleine says, it's not a programme of demands at the moment. What do you think?
It's interesting. A similar pattern emerged in the United States where, you know, the august New York Times and even the Wall Street Journal, which is owned by Rupert You-Know-Who, have been more sympathetic to the Occupy Wall Street people. And that's because even the media notices just how much people are suffering. We talked a moment ago about Greece, but, you know, great swathes of the United States are economically devastated, enormous numbers of housing, great modern estates, gorgeous houses, all abandoned, unemployment rate 9%, but in many ways people have been unemployed for over a year. It's about 15 or 16%. There is a fearsome crisis. So this wholesome expression, manifestation at St. Paul's, they hit a soft target, but that often happens in these things, is articulating, in a sense, articulating, you know, a public, deep public disquiet about the financial system, as Madeleine says. That said, it's about protest, not about remedies. And you've got this tension again. You said a moment ago, you know, Plato took a snooty view of democracy. He thought the whole show ought to be run by Madeleine's experts. They were called the guardians, as a matter of fact, if I remember. A long time since I've read any Plato. But the trouble is with experts, you can't trust them. And that's why you have to offset them with the votes of us, the great unwashed. But at the end of the day, it's a balance of head and heart. If we get, as a result of all this, tougher legislation by the government, because at the end of the day it comes back to politics, and a tougher line on the city, on taxation, taxation rates, on the regulation, on the separation effective between what they call retail banking, what you and I do, and speculative banking, which is what the investment arm do, things like that, you can get real gains. But don't kid yourself that we can get there simply on expressions of goodwill and decent people, articulate spokesmen like we had a minute ago, because, you know, you only have to look at the hopeless politics of the Church of England to know that you have to have competent people in charge who know where they're going. And alas, the Church, yet again, I say this with some sorrow, has been found woefully lacking in decisive leadership at a critical juncture when the spotlight has been on it these last 2 weeks. Resignations aren't the right answer. They almost never are. But they found themselves by the end of the fortnight in a position where resignations were the only way out. That's not good.
Just before I come to Nils, Madeleine, do you think the Church has handled it in the rather catastrophic way Mike has suggested, or do you think there's a case to be made for them?
Well, yeah, I think there is a case. I was bridling somewhat because, okay, it's been messy, but in some ways, again, you know, I quite like the rawness of it. You know, we had people who knew right from the start, like Giles Fraser, how to sort of take the line, and there were other things. Now, I think part of this is a particular problem about St. Paul's and some of the other city churches, which have huge upkeep costs, which, of course, as we've been repeatedly reminded in the last few days, don't get much help from the taxpayer. So the Church of England is caught in this really confusing position of maintaining all these vast tourist attractions and at the same time being the sort of prophetic voice of the, you know, the Christian tradition. Now, they are very difficult things to put together, and in the city, they're clearly, at St. Paul's, haven't managed to do that. St. Paul's understanding of itself and its purpose has been corrupted by its proximity to money. And anyone who ever has visited Giles in the last few years has kind of come away gaping at the kind of immense wealth all around that institution, which has been going into the institution. It's a pretty profitable place, St. Paul's, these days with its large tourist revenues. And that, unfortunately, took the top hand. Now, the point is that, you know, a week on and this situation has totally turned around and, you know, we've had resignations and we've had Richard Charters and we've had Rowan totally turning this around. So I'm thinking, actually, it's not that bad for the Church of England. It's ended up in the right place. It just took a messy time getting there.
Now, Nils, interesting take on the church there, but what about the other half of it, the city? Could you see the rather vague but very strongly felt words from people like Naomi Colvin being translated into a kind of programme that a government might be able to carry out? Rowan Williams had a bit of a go himself in the FT yesterday, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of points here. I mean, Bob Diamond, the boss of Barclays, will be giving his big BBC speech, BBC lecture this evening. I mean, I strongly suspect he will be addressing some of these themes. You know, Diamond has banged on in the recent past.
About, I hope we're not paying him for it, Nils.
You have to ask the BBC. I think he's doing it for free, Mike, I think, but he can afford to do so. I suspect he'll be banging on about citizenship. That will be one of the role of citizenship for banks. You know, it's a theme he's talked about in the past. But, you know, what he says, I suspect, will be judged this time, you know, will be weighed against what the occupied people are saying. You know, so to that extent, I think they have...
They've
spooked them a bit. They've kind of, you know, changed the public debate a little bit, which is a very good thing, and we should applaud it. But I was very glad to hear that your interviewee was talking about convening a policy group, because I think, you know, once we've applauded the symbolism, acknowledged the wholesomeness of it, you've really got to start talking about policy ideas. And, you know, that's where we get to. So good news.
Well, I completely agree with Nils. And the great concern I've got at the moment when they set up this policy group is that they're going to try reinventing the wheel, because the most important thing they can do is actually pull together and give a new platform to all kinds of people that have been beavering away trying to think, you know, like the New Economics Foundation or Compass. You know, they've all come up with plan Bs, they've come up with banking proposals. And it's, you know, they really need to tap into all kinds of knowledge networks, which have been, you know, working really, really hard on this. The worst thing is if they come up with their own programme of proposals in 2 weeks under a rather chilly tent. You know, that would be a disaster.
And I agree with Madeline, because some of this stuff is harder than it looks. I mean, you know, the waterbed principle applies everywhere, isn't it? You push on one bit and then the problem comes up somewhere else. You know, there's no easy answers here.
Mike, I mean, one thing people are absolutely fed up about, and Middle England's very fed up about as well, are the sort of phone number salaries in much of the city. And even the ones that the public owns, we're still told, oh, we've got to attract talent by paying these ludicrous sums of money. What do you think it'd be the end of the world if we just paid these people in the way that you might have done the bureaucrat who used to run, I don't know, the Yorkshire Water Board or something?
Well, we've all been infected by this performance-related pay racket, and it is a racket. Otherwise, most of them, these last two or three years, would go home with no money at all. Even distinguished liberal newspapers have had a bit of problem on this score. and so has the fellow who ran the Yorkshire Water Board. I bet he gets a performance-related pay whenever it rains. So it's a pernicious aspect of the marketization of our society. Senior civil servants as well might wonder about their performance-related pay. I just think that it's very difficult to do in isolation, but it is something which we can bear down on those aspects of the economy. You mentioned the state-controlled banks, RBS and so on, where we can make a difference, then we should make a stand. Interestingly enough, David Cameron this week was quizzed about it at Prime Minister's Question Time, and he said we need more shareholder power controlling these remuneration committees, which are a bit of a you scratch my back and I'll scratch your back sort of setup. Well, that's fine, except the shareholders never deliver on that. And secondly, more interesting, and I'm not just saying this because Madeline's on the programme, he said more women on the boardroom. A really interesting point, because there is some research evidence that the presence of a significant number of women on boardrooms makes boardrooms behave more calmly and less riskily, and would have a more sensible, good word, effect on pay. So let's be positive. Dave is... you know, he hasn't got as many women as he said he would in the cabinet, but he's made the thought.
Well, on that rare outbreak of yes we can from Michael White, we're going to draw things to a close. If you want a dose instead of no we cannot, you can follow developments at Cannes G20 Summit over the weekend on our website. Assuming that international capitalism holds up for another week, we'll be back on Thursday. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark. Thanks very much to our guests and look forward to speaking to you again then.
Nova is America's most watched science series. You'll find it every night at 7:50 on PBS, Sky Channel 166, Virgin Media 243. PBS, where television matters.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.